You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This is episode number 4, The Digital. Picking up where we left off in discussing the historical context that shaped this generation, in this episode, we'll hear from this cohort on their relationship to digital tools and projects within architecture and the digital world more broadly. Most members of this generation are millennials and encountered the internet as adolescents or young adults. The arc of the internet in their lives began with a dream of global exchange and intellectual freedom, and has since calcified into the ubiquitous, algorithmically isolating social media landscape we know today. To begin, we'll hear how this group understood the internet over their lives as it grew in scale and became more and more integrated into contemporary life. Here's Ashley Bingham, Eric Herman, and Stuart Hicks.
So obviously we went our entire, let's say, childhood and into high school without, not that the internet didn't exist, but it wasn't ubiquitous in the way that it is today. And so I think in some ways we take advantage of technology more directly than I see some of my younger students today. Because for us, it's still a kind of magic. Because you remember a time before it, it still feels like a kind of endless possibility.
I feel like we're kind of the generation that witnessed the Big Bang. Mm. It was for a moment, I think, when the internet started to become part of our lives, it was always about an expansiveness. It was always about new connections that could possibly be forged. And now we're watching the universe contract really, really, really quickly, where it's more of a series of bubbles or smaller networks and increasingly self-selected audiences that are composing, you know, that dimension of our lives. Having witnessed that puts us in a really, in a different position than I think that the people we interact with the most are actually these students, these younger people, who I think have a probably a very understandable cynicism about these systems, one that we've come to see and understand over a long period of time. But for them, it's immediate, and it's what the internet's been the entire time.
I think for our generation, big shifts in our education was the acceptance of the computer in the workflow, not just peripheral experimentation. Like, it's about a centralization of those things. And I think a different idea about architectural proliferation and how it's received in media, through social media and things like that. Not that those things were invented in our generation, but I think that those things shifted while we were working. And so I think the evolution of our practice has been dealing with that at every level.
As a generation who saw the internet evolve and shift in real time, the memory of that mutability might yield more excitement and experimentation than the generation who follows, who are digital natives with a more blasé attitude towards the corporatized internet of apps that they've always known. The growth of the internet as an omnipresent media technical environment has had wide-ranging impacts. The internet has become a tool for both design research and professional practice. It's set the terms for the circulation of architectural images and discourse, and it's become a site of architectural speculation itself. As the internet has changed, this cohort has related to it differently, both as architects and individuals. We'll hear from Curtis Roth, Hans Tursack, and Kyle Reynolds, discussing their relationship to the internet over the course of their lives and professional careers.
So I think if we imagine that the internet of the 90s was an alternative world, the internet of today is a world which is deeply concerned with mining us as physical people existing in the world or whatever, through things like, you know, analytics, tracking, and so on.
You know, I would say another thing that defines my generation would be like the advent of the internet. You know, I remember getting my first computer, and then I also remember getting like America Online and, you know, accessing architecture that way, as opposed to like through books printed by Princeton Architectural Press and Lars Mueller. Of course, I admire those publications and that like those institutions, but they no longer have an exclusive hold on, you know, we publish the most interesting discourse on experimental architecture. It's everywhere.
I remember working in an office when you'd have to pay hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to get a satellite image of a specific site. And then all of a sudden overnight, you know, Google Earth appears and everybody can see the entire planet in a top-down view. And I think it completely transformed the way that people, architecture work on sites, view context and surroundings. You can see the same thing with the introduction of the iPhone. You know, I was in grad school when the iPhone came, like I had a flip phone, and 2 years of grad school and then the iPhone kind of emerging completely transforms it again. Like now it in your pocket is available kind of like anything you could possibly ever want and any set of information that you could want immediately accessible, right, at all times in any space. I think a number of like apps that were developed and just the range of tools available to this group made it kind of an unlimited set of explorations that one could do. Now everything is a potential area for design and a potential toolkit to work on.
As the internet was increasingly becoming a tool of both daily life and architectural work, softwares, digital fabrication tools, and the discourse around parametricism was proliferating in architecture schools. The mood was optimistic and progressive. Architects were working on extracting novel architectural languages and forms from these technological developments, and were successfully translating them into high-profile buildings across the world. Most famously, the Yokohama Port Terminal. This optimism around digital tools and the architecture they made possible was the backdrop of this generation's introduction into architectural culture. Here's Katie McDonald, Michael Meredith, Meredith Miller, Michelle Chang, and Andrew Holder reflecting on this time.
The first digital turn is the time of experimentation with new tools, which have not yet matured, right? So it's essentially a bunch of people having fun trying to get these tools to do certain things or trying to really identify the capacities of these tools.
I came out of a moment where it was a high level of technical expertise. Like, so when I graduated in schools, we're really also dealing with things like the parametric at a high level. So even Scott, for sure, was doing all the discretizing surfaces and, you know, even the stuff with Monica Nader, the parametric was in there in some ways, and Intricacy was a show that was going on. And it was like shop architects, they were young and they would say things like the few, you know, mass customization, it's going to be as affordable to do these crazy wacky buildings as the boxes or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, and it was a promise of technology that was being sold to all of us as students. The distributed office. I mean, I believe that's even our website, the moss-office.net. We believed in it all.
I feel like a lot of the design that I saw and was even a part of in school and working in offices, that there was this kind of, I'm trying to find the right words for it, but a kind of formal exuberance maybe, or an idea of the way in which technology could shape architecture was through a formal kind of complexity and smoothness, and maybe almost like a kind of perfection.
The just explosion of digital technology that was happening around the time that I was studying architecture and still is accelerating. I'm talking about sort of digital media technology, computers, rendering, scripting, all the sort of NURBS camp versus the mesh camp, like all this stuff. That still seemed really hopeful as opposed to positivist. And maybe like as opposed to a kind of context wherein every choice was so laden with the alignment of yourself with ideologies. It was a moment when, to me, things were exploding and people were just trying to, like, struggling to understand those frameworks as a kind of hopeful time.
When I was in graduate school, that was a moment that I would characterize as the kind of high watermark of the digital project, whatever that means. Like, certainly it was still well in play in the years 2002 through 2005. Those were also the years when the Sendai MediaTek and FOA's Yokohama Port Terminal building were almost ubiquitous in terms of images circulating in architecture, publications, discourse. Those, I would say, operated as confirmations of what I was already learning in school. This seemed to be like offering a certain kind of security, really, to the project as we understood it from our point of view as graduate students, and a kind of promise that the economic systems of the world were lining up to receive us.
Coming to architecture during the peak of the discipline's infatuation with digital tools and aesthetics meant that this generation became proficient in digital softwares, manufacturing techniques, and schools of form making. Termed the digital turn by Mario Carpo, this was a time when architecture as a field expanded its technical expertise from drafting to 3D modeling, and from working in wood shops to working with mechanical arms and laser cutters. When the barrier to entry was high, both in terms of cost and specialized knowledge required, these skills were highly concentrated in top-rated schools. In the early days of the digital turn, these proficiencies were incredibly valuable and sought after. Early adopters of new technologies and softwares found themselves at the forefront of design culture and high in priority for hiring in the profession and the academy. Here are Jerome Hafford, Michael Young, Paul Preisner, and Stuart Hicks on their changing relationship to software at this time.
I think that is a big distinguisher of my generation, is that we were the first ones who not only were talking about computer software, also learning it and able to do it. Because there was a bit of a disconnect there for a few years of our professors who were trying to teach and theorize this stuff, but they themselves were either just learning it or didn't know how to use it either. Whereas my age group are now the ones who then were in school and leaving school with this native digital kind of skill set.
The computer and digital work at Columbia became so hot and so quick, and the people who really knew how to teach it were so few that they entered into a kind of demand. And this was, we should remember too, at a certain level, student driven.
I got out of school and Columbia really gave me a lot of opportunity with learning new softwares, and it was also becoming new within school. Greg Lin was there, Hani Rashid was there, Winka Doubledom was there, you know, I think Sulan Kolatan and Bill McDonald were there, and it was what the school was doing, and there weren't very many schools doing that at all at the time. So I left the school with literal like capabilities in software that other people didn't have, and it gave me some kind of opportunities, right? Like, I think that's one reason I was able to get a job at SOM so easily after just moving to Chicago and also to teach at SciArc. And so I was just working with those things for a while because it's what I had, and I was getting some attention for it, or at least able to like make a living with jobs out of it.
When we first started working, you could be really good at something on the computer, and that could be enough to operate at a firm. So like, I could make renderings and that got me a job. Then starting on our own, sort of trying to think about how the making of renderings could be central. And when we started looking at what's out there, you know, with how work was being proliferated, there was just an opportunity for ideas competitions and conceptual architecture to find an audience, because it could be put on the internet in ways that it would have been much more difficult before. So trying to say, okay, let's make a rendering that can construct a story and then proliferate it on the internet. Like, there's an audience for that. That's kind of how we started. because there was an opportunity there. But then that seems kind of short-sighted as a means of building up your practice, because renderings and stories don't get you client work.
The technical skills this generation acquired during their schooling were given a material outlet through the explosion of digital fabrication tools in architecture programs. The proliferation of CNC machines and robot arms led to a specific vein of aesthetic and craft-focused research that aimed to bring down to earth the headier discourse around parametric and digital architecture. These projects, often installations, were recognizable for their quasi-biological assembly and composition of many particulate parts. They frequently made arguments about simplified models of assembly, modularity, and systems thinking. Andrew Holder and Anna Niemark both articulated disciplinary arguments for the rise of digital fabrication tools.
This group was sort of attempting to work out their relationship to practice and building in the wake of a sort of forerunner generation. And so the form that took was a kind of hands-on appropriation of the like CNC tools in the shop, such that there would be basically almost zero gap between the architect and the tools of production. That sort of reduction of the gap would potentially like squeeze out the general contractor, and architects would be working in a kind of unmediated way with audience. And so that desire to kind of like squeeze out the mediating layer, I think, led really naturally to the pavilionization of young architects' work.
The dominant mode of research was definitely trying to understand how the parametric language of design could sync up with some of the fabrication machines in the shop. And so there was a lot of emphasis on the translation of what used to be, let's say, like theoretical or intellectual conversations into conversations about code and about craft.
These arguments call back to the earlier discussion of digital optimism and this generation's initial belief in the expansiveness of the internet. The dream of mass customization, or the democratization of the construction process, perhaps felt within reach when you could fabricate building components with little more than a CNC machine and a laptop. However, this generation found the limited possibilities of the dominant DigiFab project were quickly exhausted, and they described various disciplinary flight paths that utilized their fabrication skills but oriented them towards more interesting ends. For Curtis Roth, attending to the politics of technology more broadly was productive and corresponds directly with his work on labor, digital interfaces, and drawing machine style painting.
When I was in school, it was really the moment in which every school was getting robots for the first time, and in which that question of how do you take a robot and like make 5,000 things, which you then bolt together manually by hand, was the question. And I spent basically my entire MArch just sort of doing that. There was a real dissatisfaction in that way of sort of thinking about how we have sort of relegated technology to the way to cut things out, basically. It was like the only way we were using technology. And that, in fact, technology was at the same time becoming much more present in our lives, in, or at least the perception of technology, in really profound ways. I feel like that disjuncture was so sudden that I think that for a whole group of people, the question was really maybe like, how do we engage the cultural and political dimensions of technology, not even architectural technology, but technology in general through architecture?
For Andrew Holder and Jimenez Lai, the craft logic of digital fabrication was a dead end. For Lai specifically, Bob Sommel's arguments for shape, silhouette, and audience engagement were a strategy for moving away from the craft fetish of DigiFab culture.
I also think it was a very intentional decision by the generation just above me to invest very heavily in a kind of craft logic of the digital. I think they would all take exception to me terming it craft, but I have no other word for like the desire to be in the workshop directly manipulating the object that is then sold as architecture. So to me, my understanding of that is craft. And as soon as the investments were made in craft, then there was a limited theoretical armature that one could invoke to understand what was good and what was bad, what was valuable, and what had like societal consequence. You can kind of buy crafts and you can commission them, but it's very difficult to know what other kinds of effects they have in the world beyond the like pleasure of their acquisition and the pleasure of their making.
That expression of labor extended so much so that in the early stages of people who felt, let's say, quote unquote, critical, needed to CNC every brick or 3D print every component so that the craft of the brick was the conversation. And this felt to me like not so different from the Van Gogh brushstroke. Like the technique of the brushstroke is excellent. And, you know, but once I came upon the Lichtensteins of the world, it in fact takes so much effort to appear effortless, right? In the case of Lichtenstein, you know, the smoothness of that surface condition was one way that I began to understand Bob's work. Must an architectural diagram be incredibly difficult in order for it to be appreciated intellectually? Or could the excellence of the concealment of the intellectual work be the sleight of hand?
And Kyle Schumann argues for a shift away from seeing what digital fabrication tools can produce and towards designing more specific digifab tools to produce with. This approach can be seen in his practice with Katie McDonald, After Architecture, which has developed a series of custom robot sawing machines for working with non-standard cuts of wood.
So if you look at Generation Past, where like the CNC was a new thing and let's say architectural production is about kind of how do we utilize this technology, right? How do we bridge from digital form to physical form? And now I think because of the parallel development of technology and DIY movements and Arduinos and things like that make it so much easier for people with not such specialized knowledge in like computer science and these other highly technical fields, it makes it possible for architects and designers to, I think, engage with those technologies on a more fundamental level, where it's not so much anymore saying necessarily, what can I do with this CNC mill, but maybe saying on a more fundamental level, how can I like reinvent the CNC mill?
So far, we've discussed this generation's early relationship to the internet and their experience of digital skill acquisition in school. Next, we'll turn towards Greg Lynn as a key influence and a metonym for the digital project in architecture more broadly. Lynn's writings, practice, and teaching were incredibly impactful. He taught at Columbia's Paperless Studios before migrating to UCLA under Sylvia Lavin, where many members of this generation were taught. His seminal Folding in Architecture issue of AD, along with his book Animate Form, established him as a protagonist of architecture's digital project. Outside of his writing and practice, he personally interacted with many members of this generation during his time teaching at UCLA. Here's Kyle Miller, John Lott, Kelly Baer, and Niran Turan.
When I was at UCLA, because of the focus on the kind of continued evolution of all things digital and algorithmic thinking, like there was no history prior to Eisenman. And you could even extend that and exaggerate it and say Greg Lynn was the kind of first architect for our lineage.
I think people were curious about that next LA generation, which was post-Morphosis, post-Gary. Not that they're done practicing, but I think in a way they had a moment and we were interested in and curious about probably what Greg Lynn was bringing to the table. At the same time, I think our group didn't have a wholehearted embrace of that, let's say, exuberant formalism.
My graduate education in some ways was extended through the opportunity of teaching with Greg Lynn for many years in Vienna. So I never worked with him professionally in his practice, but I did develop a way of enhancing and expanding my workflow through a five-year dialogue with him through our studio and his studio in Vienna, Austria.
When I arrived in the United States, there was a lot of discussion on the Greg Lynn and the formalism of that was kind of up and going down, meaning people were questioning the idea of, let's say, maybe digital formalism in certain ways.
Despite Lynn's influence and this group's engagement with and excitement for his work, the optimism around the digital project didn't last. A key through line for this generation is their transition away from the digital project in nearly every way, politically, aesthetically, and representationally, despite the critical role that digital tools and discourses played in their schooling. The synthesis of their technical capacity and their ideological rejection of the digital can be seen as a generational ambition. This cohort is trying to find ways to practice architecture in a digital environment while working against the parametric. Here's Kyle Miller and Matthew Au on their sense of the shift away from the digital project.
I think of us as a group of people that were born into a digital paradigm, but we're not the authors of it, and so didn't feel a sense of ownership over it like the people that completed the paperless studios did in the 90s. And then I think on the other end, we were very comfortable to just swim around in it rather than challenge it. And so that's why I say 2012, because I think there was a number of people that started to graduate around that time that looked at all things digital through a critical lens and kind of challenged it, turned it on its head and maybe moved in different directions while still, let's say, adopting its use.
LA in general at that time, and even continuing today, is still heavily dominated or influenced by a particular generation out of Columbia in the late 90s. The heavier figures at that time, of course, were Greg Lynn and a few others that they passed through CYRIC at the time. We end up with theoretical figures like Manuel de Landa, passing through a couple of others that were Bernard Cachet, all people that were carrying this sort of heavy progression towards a digital project. By the time that I had graduated, it felt like that project was waning, or at least the coupling of a sort of technical apparatus to a theoretical apparatus. The people that were closest to me that developed their projects in, I actually think in very similar ways would be, so Aaron Bessler graduated the year after I did, and then David Eskenazi the year after. I think we were all in a position of just trying to figure out like how to build a new conversation outside of the sort of pretty heavy dominant digital conversation that was happening within CYRIC in particular.
While it was clear that digital workflows weren't going anywhere, the novelty of these tools had worn off. The shift away from the digital project in architecture aligned with a much broader sense that technology was not a straightforward liberating force. Digital architecture, or parametricism, whose aesthetics were so closely tied to computation, were a casualty of this cultural reevaluation. Here's Neron Turan, Michael Meredith, and Clark Tenhouse.
And I think that one thing might be this, let's say, dissatisfaction with the promise of technology or more, you know, techno-optimism, maybe we can put it that way broadly, because it's not just a matter of digital techniques and computer, but it's more an attitude towards technology.
The promise that email was going to make your life more efficient has turned out to be baloney or something. You know what I mean? Like, I think people just feel it. Technology has not been as liberating. It's not liberating either. I think at some level it is, like, here we are, we're talking to each other through this, but I don't think it could ever live up to this utopian desires as it was presented to everybody. I feel like that's been the big shift. And I think that's also been the shift in architecture to some degree.
I think at a certain point, the amount of seamless, curvy, shapy forms or tessellated, modulated building skins, like, it has sort of become exhausted. And I think there is this just interest bubbling all around about connecting the digital tools to broader social, cultural, even political domains.
Outside of larger societal narratives around technology, this generation also articulated a series of critiques of the Parametric Project. Specifically, they found the focus on craft and method myopic. They saw the aesthetic smoothness as out of sync with the current moment. They found the bold discursive and formal strategies as bombastic, and they viewed the movement's protagonists as compromised by capital. This series of rejections gives this generation a shared enemy through which they could define their own identity, which came to be characterized by simple detailing, an affinity for the bumpy, rough, or crude, a commitment to discursive humility and distributed authorship, and suspicion around architecture's entanglements with wealth. Here are Jimenez Lai, Meredith Miller, Paul Preisner, and Michael Young discussing their criticisms of the digital.
The generation maybe before me, with the exception of a few people, so focused on how, and they can't help it. You know, you can't really blame the people from that generation because they were introduced to the computer, or the, you know, the new ways in which the computer allowed them to explore technicalities of the new hows. At which point, the what it didn't really matter somehow. Between 90s digital architecture, like proto-parametricism, and, you know, landscape urbanism, also in the 90s, experiencing the tail end of that on my end left me frustrated with people who didn't seem to be interested in what.
There's a way in which we see the world as a messy place that doesn't resolve into singular ideas or singular forms. And I think that kind of messy context, which is both the physical world, but also our digital lives, right? The kind of mediations that we're steeped in, the depthlessness of the internet, the way in which images and culture are around us all the time, these kind of incoherent, ungrouped, this variety of culture and aesthetics that we confront all the time. And so maybe what I'm saying is that that is a context which a lot of these designers are operating in, and it's hard to see that the architectural response would be this kind of singular, smooth, resolved, coherent thing.
You always assume that you're all for the same thing and trying to maybe turn the tables over on, you know, the world you're in and figure out a new one. And then you start to learn that some of the people just, what they didn't like about the world the way it was, wasn't the world the way it was, but just that they weren't on the top of it.
Everybody's working digitally, but nobody's talking about it. And that's, I think, also interesting, too. And some of that has to do with the toxicity of a character like Patrick Schumacher, who just made it so problematically painful to ever use like a word like parametric, that, you know, because this list here, there's not a single person there that doesn't use parametric software, but I don't know a single person there that would ever talk about it either.
There probably was some distaste for the success of Zaha and the obnoxiousness of Schumacher, because I also have had those types of resistances, or the just the weird way that the work of what Greg had started to do started to trend into just making baubles for Swarovski, you know, like jewelry or something, or these weird expensive robots to follow you around and carry your champagne or something. Like, just it started to seem so stupid what role in the world that type of work started taking place, that seemed maybe not worth pursuing. But some of it also is probably, in a bigger sense, it happened around the same time that people started communicating with each other through social media much more, right? And so I think that had the effect of, even though you're ostensibly connected to more people, you're starting to feel less connected to any people in particular.
Next, we'll turn towards the subject of social media and the communication landscape it's produced for architecture. As Preisner just pointed out, critiques of parametricism coincided with the spread of social media. While we've heard this generation discuss how they were inheritors of a digital project and not its authors, they are the first generation to grapple with the impacts of social media on architecture. While the emergence of the internet was a feature of this generation's childhood, social media platforms sprung up much later. Facebook began in 2004, Tumblr in 2007, both Pinterest and Instagram in 2010 and TikTok in 2016. Despite its relative novelty, social media was understood by this cohort as a key context for contemporary work in architecture. We'll hear more about social media throughout this issue of Attention, as this group discussed its impacts on aesthetics, debate, politics, and architectural theory. The ecosystem of cultural circulation that Instagram and other social media platforms have produced means that work is primarily delivered as fragmented, bite-sized pieces of content. This condition poses questions about the state of authorship and the ability for architecture to communicate politically or ideologically. Social media's utilization of personalized algorithms and its preference for video and image over text has impacted architectural culture. Here's Eric Herman and Kyle Reynolds.
The work that we would describe as disciplinary and at the center of like the attention of all the other peers that are talking in this generation, that work comes accompanied with metadata like apps and text and captions and things that explain or do things that are beyond the limits and the boundaries of the object or the aesthetics. And so that's a completely different relationship than a building kind of dropped in a context and you kind of confronting it and having to interpret it based on, you know, its proximity to other things, its particular location, its materials, all these kind of questions. I think about this a lot too, because images circulate better than text. They circulate faster than text. And then often your text and your work is decoupled from one another. And then unless someone like you is willing to go through and do the work, or someone like Andrew Holder is willing to like do the work and begin to speculate and try to make sense of it all again, it's just out there and it can be used and instrumentalized in a lot of ways you wouldn't have expected. Whether it's an image that's captured and then printed and used as a precedent in a studio, or if your work gets stuck into a meme and something, you know, completely changes the meaning of the project. And so I think that we try to be a little bit comfortable with the idea that the work is not going to be able to explain everything that we think.
Instagram might be a primary tool for communicating, like you said, with Kyle Miller's quote from Possible Mediums, you know, work in progress, right? Things that people are up to. It's a really quick and easy way to see what collectively people are working on, right? So I think that's nice, like in a way, like just being able to kind of see what everyone's doing instantaneously in a way that wasn't available to us in the past is great. It also, you know, as many people have pointed out, runs the risk of just being very easily processed and then forgotten about.
Criticisms of the shallowness of social media were common and convincing. As we all know, social media has become a dominant presence that reshapes not just the way architectural culture manifests, but shapes our individual habits, attention, and relationships. This generation frequently found that social media was vapid and unsatisfying, and they were discouraged by their students' reliance on the quick, fast searching it encourages, in lieu of the sustained curiosity that more traditional research invites. Here are Michael Young, Hans Tersak, Kyle Miller, and Kyle Schumann.
Now there's a daily feed and you look at it for a second, maybe less than a second, and you never come back to it, and it passes and it goes again. And it's only things that are then positioned again and again and again and again and again that seem to kind of have any sticking or staying power. We maybe feel that we're getting filled with contemporary ideas about architecture. So we don't feel that emptiness. We feel like we're getting our calories. Maybe we're not getting our nutrients, but we're getting our calories.
The internet's so disorientingly huge, but you know, we can talk about like social media versus academically sanctioned databases like JSTOR and ArtStore, which are pretty careful about what goes in and how it's organized. I'm going to sound very conservative here. Like, things that you have really quick access to are often fairly shallow, and things that take a little bit longer to find might offer you more depth, or more, maybe not depth in terms of quality and authority, but depth in terms of other avenues to find other stuff. and do more sustained research, let's say, not necessarily better, but more sustained. So searching on JSTOR for articles will lead you to footnotes that will lead you to other articles that are, 400 words in length. You'll probably get a lot of content out of it and be able to dive into something very specific, looking at whatever is on ArcDaily. You'll get something fast and beautiful images, but it won't probably, it's less likely to lead you to like a sustained research project.
The other part of it was just iPhone Google search replacing journals and libraries. And so all day students are scrolling through uncurated image feeds. We've got to find a way to get them to understand the value of retaining that knowledge and building links between practices, understanding bodies of work, understanding disciplinary lineages, because that really does come to bear on how they practice, even in the most practical way. Like subconsciously, they're all regurgitating watered down versions of canonical things.
But I also find that among students, you would think that then they have access to all this stuff. They should be able to go and find certain like software tutorials or various things. But I also find that a lot of students are requesting tutorials and things in class. There's almost in some ways a reluctance to rely on those sources of knowledge. But at the same time, all the students have their Pinterest boards of like inspirational images they bring into Studio, and then half the time people don't know like what this building is or who did it or where it came from or what its program is, right? It's like purely an aesthetic thing. And so, yeah, in some ways, I think there's disconnects between all this knowledge is available, right? But maybe the speed at which it's processed reduces it or distills it down to certain aesthetic effects.
Outside of social media's impact on attention, research, and the ways we encounter architecture more broadly, algorithmically sorted platforms also shape contemporary aesthetics. The lack of traditional gatekeepers, such as publishers, means information circulates indiscriminately and immediately. The algorithmic organization of content also incentivizes types of media that boost engagement and keep users active, both of which are corporate goals that are not invested in the development of a discourse or the careful, slow work of developing knowledge. Both Katie McDonald and Kyle Reynolds saw Instagram as negatively impacting aesthetic development.
There are these waves of aesthetic interest that I can see cycle through Instagram, I don't know, every 3 to 6 months. And it passes too quickly for ideology or discussion, and then it's on to the next project, almost like a fashion season.
Other things that we've observed that kind of permeate Instagram and other modes of media production is like a very specific, highly curated environment where everything is very carefully selected and placed in such a way to have its own story that you can then talk about in the caption or in the article, right? Like it's almost as if the design is presupposing the eventual article or blog post or Instagram post about it, right? It's not really about the design itself, but the way that one can present it and talk about it in this larger context. So, I mean, that is something that really, I mean, we just can't stand that type of work, that kind of like highly curated version of image making, which I think, exists in multiple disciplines at multiple levels within those disciplines. And so something that we were trying to kind of tease out is like, is there other ways that we can begin to collect and arrange and organize space, which I think gets back to some of the interests of this group as a whole, that would undercut that or undo it or produce a new way of looking at maybe curatorial practices. And so one of the things that, I'm particularly interested in at the moment is just like a level of messiness and uncleanliness, a way of putting things together in such a manner that there's no discernible organizational structure that underlies it.
However, this generation still regarded social media as a medium and tool that could be worked with and through. Instead of just using these platforms to post work and advertise one's practice, social media was seen as a site of architectural intervention. As we discussed in our episode on genealogy, this group was exposed to a post-critical or projective discourse during their schooling, which emphasized the cultivation of new audiences, an imperative which aligns with both the capacities and incentives of social media. Kyle Reynolds and Andrew Kovacs both discuss early experiments in thinking about how architecture can interface with social media.
My partner, Jeff, made this Twitter account, and it might still be running, which was No Stop Twitter, which would essentially, there's an automated program that every so often would recombine a series of emojis to produce this continuous feed of, like, No Stop City, right, essentially, and go on infinitely, right? So now this became a kind of grounds for experimentation in a way that wasn't possible in the past. So a number of new mediums opened up different tools, maybe simpler tools, right? Like not a complete reliance on like digital modeling software or digital fabrication tools. I don't know what you would call them. They're not like low-tech tools, but they're just more easily accessible.
When I started graduate school in 2010, I just started a Tumblr account, which I called Archive of Affinities. I would share or upload images that at the time were related to maybe a project I was working on in a studio context, academic studio context. Princeton, of course, had this amazing library, and I would go to the library and just randomly browse books and take them off the shelf and then go sit next to a scanner and flip through these books. And every time I liked something, I would scan it. I just kept doing it. It became also like a way for me to find things I hadn't seen before, right? So at some point, you kind of exhaust like tracking down who is interested in who and who is referencing who. And then it there was a kind of maybe randomness to just browsing the library. Like it was literally like just walking through and like, oh, what's that title? What's that title? Pick it off the shelf, flip through it. If there was something that instantly caught my eye, it went into a pile of books that I took to the scanner and then digitized. And then eventually, most likely, uploaded to the internet. Things like roadside architecture, for me, was also a way that, let's say, architecture could connect to a broader audience. Everyone can realize that, oh, that's kind of funny. It's like a building that looks like a duck or an orange. So it was like architects that didn't like those buildings, but the broader public of non-architects could somehow find an opening into architecture through those buildings.
Anna Niemark also brought up the Archive of Affinities project.
Andrew Kovacs has completely rewritten what it is to even understand what the discipline of architecture is. Certainly has taken on this archival or almost like a digital humanity approach.
Between the broad critiques of the corporate capture of the internet in the social media age, and this generation's experimentation with the possibilities that these platforms hold, we are left with questions about how architects and students should engage with architecture online. Is abstaining from Instagram and its trend cycles a choice more people should make? Or are its 2 billion monthly users too important to ignore? Should architecture resist the influence of these new media technologies, or embrace the new modes of attention and instantaneous sharing that they encourage? With this generation's relationship to the digital in mind, through the internet, social media, and their skill acquisition in architecture school, we'll conclude this episode with their response to this set of conditions, termed the post-digital. Post-digital is a key word that's been used in art, music, and architectural discourses, and typically gestures towards an attitude that doesn't reject technology or the digital, but is uninterested in its novelty, innovation, or liberatory claims. 2017's Becoming Digital Conference, hosted in Michigan at the Taubman School of Architecture, was a key moment for post-digital discourse in architecture, which reckoned with the revolutions in architectural labor and human relationality that the digital represents. The work gave voice to this generation's critiques of parametricism and their responses to the omnipresence of digital tools, spaces, and flows of communication, both in architecture and everyday life. Here's Brittany Udding and Hans Tersak.
It was a really interesting moment. There was a great conference organized by Ellie Abrams, Adam Fury, and Andrew Holder called Becoming Digital, and I think you've been interviewing them. It was a really amazing several-year project where they invited architects and artists that were dealing with native digital environments and how they interface with the city, how they have profoundly changed our forms of representation in reading images, how increasingly the kind of virtual environment is overlaid with and deeply entangled with the built one. It was really looking at the kind of forms of architectural or ways of expressing the digital forms of production that were becoming increasingly native to architecture. And though it had a really interesting both, it had a, I think, a political imaginary, but also a relationship to our tools of production. It had a relationship to the kind of expression, the digital expressions of kind of the internet, of thinking about other sort of social relationships that could occur virtually.
One of the things that distinguishes that work, or that can be said to be something of a common denominator, even though there's a huge range of work within that, is a different attitude towards digital tools. And so I'll crib, you know, Adam Fury and Ellie Abrams' argument from Becoming Digital a little bit and say that it's a different approach to digital tools where geometry is not always and assumed to be the end game.
Many respondents highlighted this different approach to tools, thinking about how the proficiencies and softwares that were assimilated into architecture during the digital turn could be put to less straightforwardly virtuosic ends. They reacted negatively to ever more complex geometries and high-resolution imagery, while expressing interest in aesthetics that were simplified and playful. Here's Jerome Hafford, Katie McDonald, Paul Preisner, Kyle Reynolds, Clark Tenhouse, and Curtis Roth.
Some of the common threads that I see in this group is beginning to be conscious of software and tools and instruments that we're using. And so that's where, yeah, like you talk about the post-digital, I think you start to get this mannerist thinking about the tools that we're using. Self-awareness of representation of digital tools and a kind of play with them.
The post-digital seems to come in as a critique or a way to step back from some of the things the digital has allowed, like optimization, like high resolution. As people refine their work with these new tools, things become more and more crisp, more and more professional. And in a way, the post-digital seems like a critique of that. It seems like a way to say, okay, what if the render is really low resolution? What if the geometry is highly inefficient? What are the spatial capacities of work that's not optimized?
There was a moment, I think, for me that was kind of weird. Like, I did know how to render quite well, and so I started trying to figure out how to render buildings so they didn't look like real things in the world or abstract things in the world, but to start rendering digital models of projects so they just looked like photographs of physical models with all the errors and kind of minor imperfections that cutting paper has versus a digital surface, which has no imperfections, and to make renderings look a little bit less clean.
You see a lot of projects that have maybe characteristics that are difficult to replicate in digital software or digital fabrication tools that are available to us. You know, things that like slump or have a certain gravity or weight or posture to them that, you know, if you set out to kind of make that in Rhino or Revit or mill that out of a piece of foam using a robot, it's very difficult to kind of approximate that given the way that those tools operate and the things that they want to produce. And so I think there's also this undercurrent of challenging the kind of tools and techniques that we have available to us at this moment to see if we can push those in new directions.
There was individual interest bubbling all around about connecting the digital tools to broader social, cultural, even political domains that sat outside of just the digital effects. And so I think that that's also a pretty important part as I reflect on this generation is the use of these tools, not for generating new architectural effects per se, but for distributing them and considering them in relation to, you know, I guess what we'd call extra disciplinary circumstances.
A huge influence in that work would also have to be the post-digital work that's coming out of the visual arts, because I think a lot of the practices in that moment in which I at least felt like dissatisfied with the way that architecture was using technology, one of the things that I looked to was the really intelligent and, in my mind, much more politically engaging work that was coming out of the visual arts in dealing with technology, which I think had been at it maybe for a lot longer than architecture.
The post-digital was also characterized by this looking outside of disciplinary architecture and towards the larger social and political valences of technology. As we discussed earlier, optimism around the internet had largely faded, leaving this generation to offer a critical response. The combination of their specific historical relationship to the internet's takeover by social media platforms and their refusal to continue the project of digital formalism with the tools they inherited produces a set of distinctly generational questions. Here are Meredith Miller, Cyrus Penarroyo, and Daniel Jacobs on the questions that continue to animate their work.
The post-digital is an acceptance of the contemporary condition that we find ourselves in, where all of our experiences are mediated through digital media. Thus, our kind of expectations or our understanding, our knowledge about the physical world is always conditioned through these like digital experiences that we have. Our understanding of each other and ourselves, our identity formation, there's always these layers of how that is presented or framed or understood or projected into the world through digital media. So the physical experience, you know, being in a space with a kind of physical artifact is no more real than sort of coming to understand or encounter that material through digital media. And so in a way, design occurs in both spaces or across those spaces simultaneously.
More recently, there has been this moment where the work that's being produced exists in a world where we're surrounded by technology, and that the digital project is maybe not necessarily a kind of novel thing, but actually just a pervasive condition that we're all operating within. And so I think a lot of the work of our cohort is maybe exploring what that means, like the processes behind generating things like form or materiality. And maybe the word scenographic comes to mind. There's an attempt to produce images and also maybe to design those images with an understanding or awareness of the infrastructure or support necessary to present those images.
That was another space of inquiry into the way that we work, the methods and means and tools and making evident and making visible what is typically invisible about production mm-hmm. of the image and architecture and communicating it to a different audience, right? That's, I think, a lot of what that thread of post-digital production really is about, which is how do you make someone question the environment that they're in, the surface of the edifice that you're standing in front of, or the virtual environment that you're clicking through or scrolling through. So understanding that discomfort or reassessment of comfort in that space, that's what those image projects are about.
These questions are in many ways new articulations of old problems in the age of smartphones and boundless digital connectivity. How should aesthetics address the relationship between form and its mode of production? How does a representational or communicative medium impact meaning and possibility? And what makes a space well designed, now that physical space is always already digital? Building on this discussion, the next episode will focus on the topics of aesthetics, audiences, and authorship. We'll hear about this generation's aesthetic keywords, their desire to expand architecture's audience outside of the discipline, and the question of authorship. You have been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture, issue 8, talking about my generation. interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. Narration was written by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.